everybody, and welcome to Otherwhere. Thank you for tuning in. Good evening to everyone who's in Canada and the United States. Good afternoon to everybody listening in Melbourne, Australia, where we are broadcasting from, or if you're in the Asia Pacific region. And good morning if you're in the UK, Europe, or Africa. And if you're listening to this from the archives, greetings in the ever-present now. It's time for this week's all-seeing edition of Otherwhere, as we spend the next couple of hours delving into the awesome subject of the pyramids at Giza and their connection to Atlantis, with our guest William Henry, leading mythologist, esoteric researcher of art, sacred texts, and symbolism. He returned from Egypt recently, where he and a crew from the National Geographic Channel made some incredible discoveries at Abu Ghraib, a closed-to-the-public site where they found evidence that links the function of the pyramids at Giza with those at Teotihuacan in Mexico, suggesting that an earlier, advanced civilization existed in both places in the past, and that it may have its origins in Atlantis. That's coming up very shortly on the show. If you have never tuned in before, it's delightful to have your company, and I hope that you'll enjoy the program. Once again, it's called Otherwhere. And you are, of course, tuned in to bbsradio.com, with over 50 shows and 70 international show hosts on the schedule, bringing you free listening, free archives, and more world-renowned guests in a week than most radio networks in a month. Find the Otherwhere page, which will not only tell you all about the show and how to access the archives, by clicking on the right-hand side of the bbsradio.com homepage, where all the shows are in alphabetical order. All you need to do is scroll down to Otherwhere. And what is Otherwhere? Well, it's anything that activates, enhances, or evolves the inner technologies of the multidimensional human. Now, I would like you to know that even though I think I've had an incredible smorgasbord of guests on the show, and from your response out there, it's heartening to know that you agree, and we've covered some subjects that are pretty diverse, such as sacred geometry, crop circles, the Earth's cosmology and that of our galaxy, medical intuition and sound healing, star kids, ET contact, animal communication, near-death experiences, the consciousness of water, ascension, and the power of intention, I truly think that some of the most extraordinary shows I will do are yet to be done, and they will feature people like yourselves, the listeners, as we get to hear about your Otherwhere-related stories. You may not have ever published a book or had a movie made of your life, but I bet if you ever could, it would probably be fascinating, especially if your story is anything like this. This was a response that I sent out to a call to the Otherwhere Network that was prompted by the fact that it has come to my attention lately that many adults I've been in touch with lately have been reporting that when they were children, they could fly. Here's one sample from someone in the Otherwhere Network. I can fly, but have yet to remember how to do it. When I was young climbing a tree, I fell and flew to safety. About 2 years ago, I met with a clairvoyant who was reading me, and she told me that I can fly. I didn't give it much thought until I reflected on falling out of the tree as a kid. My mother tells me that she could fly when she was young. She says she could jump off the couch after watching Peter Pan and fly in the living room. And I'm pretty sure he's serious. So now I am asking you, does anybody else out there have recollections like this? If you do, I'd love it if you would consider being a guest on the show sometime to discuss this remarkable ability, or at the very least, share your story with us via email. Obviously, this is for actual experiences only. However, I would still enjoy hearing from anybody out there who knew of someone else who could do it. I think I can speak for most of us when I say that I hadn't thought this could be possible until recently. However, it appears to be more common than we thought. Please get in touch by emailing me at otherwherehost@yahoo.com. If you would like to hook up with some of the coolest people on the planet, then please think about joining the Otherwhere Network yourself. And being part of our circle of light. You can do so by visiting us on the web at groups.yahoo.com/group/otherware. Speaking of our circle of light, I would like to invite you all to join me there at the end of the show as we conclude our time together with a special extended journey into progressive yoga relaxation and an exercise to help clear and energize the third eye. I look forward to seeing you there. But first, some music on Night Grooves, and not due for release until July 3rd. You are hearing it hot off the presses. It's from Hungarian producer Zoltan, and it's a nice atmospheric bit of techie deepness that I think will kick off proceedings very nicely. And I'm pretty sure that if you listen closely, you might even hear a reference to ESP. It's from P60. It's from an EP entitled Slow Movements in the Night, and this is called Go Forward. It's with great delight that I welcome our next guest, William Henry, back to the program. He's in Nashville, Tennessee, and he's one of the leading investigative mythologists in the world and author of 12 books, including Blue Apples, God Making, The Crystal Halls of Christ's Court, Oracle of the Illuminati, The Healing Sun Code, Language of the Birds, and his latest, The Illuminator, Mary Magdalene, Solomon's Key, in which he presents new evidence about the secrets and true history of Mary Magdalene, including the reasons why she was called the Illuminator and why the Knights Templar were attacked by the Church of Rome. He's an expert on connecting the dots between ancient myths, symbolism, and sacred texts, including those of the Sumerian, Egyptian, and Mayan civilizations, and linking them to the latest discoveries in science and consciousness.
Hello.
Oh, hello, William. It's Liz Miller calling.
Hi, Liz. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Terrific. Thank you.
That's good. It's great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on, Liz. It's wonderful to talk with you, too.
You know, I really love the fact that you've come on the show to tell us about the discoveries that you've made in Egypt, because Egypt is absolutely one of my favorite subjects, and I know that there are probably many, many listeners out there who are just as fascinated with the whole subject. Now, you've just come back from there, and what were your impressions of Egypt overall?
Well, this is the second time that I've been to Egypt, and I think, just as a commentary to start off, it seems like there's as many Egypts as there are people who actually visit the place. I mean, Egypt is an actual geographical location, but it's more than that. It's a state of mind, really. I mean, in my view, the first time I went, you apprehend that you're just completely overwhelmed. You're in total awe of what you're seeing. You're seeing a merger, a not-so-subtle merger, by the way, of the ancient world and the modern world. You see a modern Cairo that is a overpopulated third-world city, and beside it you see these, for example, the Giza Plateau butting right up against modern Cairo. You just can't, you're immediately overwhelmed by having to reconcile the mating of these two cultures, the ancient Egypt and the modern Egypt, and that in itself plays incredible mind games on you. And at first you're trying to make this connection, and that becomes the very basis for your first trip. But then the second time that I went, I had extra brain capacity to actually sort of engage these temples for what they really are or were, which is workshops, places where you come to have yourself spiritually transformed. And what that requires is the opening of the heart, which is an experience that I had the second time. It was different from the first and enabled me to see and experience Egypt in a completely different way than I ever expected.
Oh, that sounds incredible. Now, you went there with a group of people. Tell me a little bit about the group of people that you traveled with. And I know that this is something that you've done on a regular basis before. You've taken people to France and other places.
Right.
Tell me about what happens when you get together with these groups and you take them to these places, because it must
well,
be magical.
You know, well, it is. It's like, as Forrest Gump said, it's like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get, okay? I mean, you talk with people on the phone, you receive emails from them, but then putting a face and a whole being to a name is a whole experience in and of itself. It is really quite magical. I mean, literally from the moment, well, I left Nashville and I flew to JFK, we all arranged to meet in New York together and fly together as a group. And as one kernel starts popping, so to speak, you all get together, and the next thing you know, you've got this whole group of people with incredible experiences under their life belt, incredible knowledge that they have to offer. It gets a little bit touchy sometimes, to be perfectly honest, when some people bring an agenda with them too. I mean, you ask them to just simply be part of a group, and the only agenda that I ask people to come onto a group experience with is, hey, I'm going to have the best time of my life. I'm going to engage in these temples in ways that I've never done before, and I'm just going to have a wonderful experience. But then it can get, as I say, a little touch and go when people have expectations beyond that, and if those expectations are not met, it sometimes, as you can imagine, turns into a little bit of trouble.
Yes, I can imagine. But I feel that you definitely deliver for the most part. We have testament to that on the new DVD, Egypt, the mm-hmm. Shadow of Atlantis, which actually came out of some lectures that you presented to this group in Egypt recently. Is that's right, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I try to make as much new material as possible. What you find in the work that I do, especially the volume of work that I produce, I view my books more as research inquiries than conclusions. I'm asking questions still rather than providing answers. And so I have some built-in redundancy so that new people coming in are going to have an idea of what we're talking about, and the old people are going to, or the people that are more experienced with the material are going to have a chance to kind of build on what they already know. And so going to Egypt was a chance for me to look at some of the old material, especially the Stargate material, and this idea that the ancient gods and goddesses in Egypt and the inscriptions that they left for us on the temple walls are about traveling the stars through gates. I also was looking more at some of the metaphysics behind that concept, as opposed to strictly looking at the artwork and saying, hey, you know, these guys are traveling in wormholes.
Well, that's actually one of the things that I noticed. It really stuck out when I watched the DVD. There's an evolution, and it's really obvious in the work that you're presenting. And I found, you know, just for an example, there were things like your references in the past to Stargates have now been slightly revised, and you refer to these places as sort of intermediate zones between this place and somewhere else.
Yeah, that was that is a real interesting evolution. The backstory on that is I was in Dayton, Ohio, giving a presentation back last fall, and there was a gentleman in my audience named Bob Vauder. Many of the listeners probably have never heard of Bob, but you've certainly heard of John Anthony West. You've probably heard of Stephen Naylor. You've probably heard of the tour guide Hakim in Egypt and others that were involved, especially in the period from 95 to 98 with opening up the Hall of Records, actually extending into 1999. Bob is a sound researcher who is deeply involved in a behind-the-scenes way with many of the Graham Hancock, other of these researchers that were trying to crack that cosmic egg in 1999. Well, he was at my presentation, and I started on this track of saying, when we see these gods being portrayed in their shrines, they look like they're divers who have come up from the deep ocean and are in some kind of a decompression chamber. They're in an intermediate realm. They're in between, they're interphase, if you will. They're in between man and God, or God and total cosmic being. And Bob saw me talking about that and really got buzzed by it, because it's so much of the ancient technology was about sound, and it did clearly appear to him that, hey, you're right, these guys are in some kind of a transporter room or transporter beam, an interphasic realm. And he highly encouraged me to keep on that path. So I kept in touch with Bob and started to really develop that line of research.
Yeah, it's really good to see. And I think it's wonderful for someone who is in your position where you've basically made it your life's work to connect the dots, to see how you're remaining very, very open-minded about the work that you're studying and presenting to others. And I think it definitely instills confidence to the people who follow what you do, and I've been following your work for many years now. And it's just so great to see someone who's got the ability to not just get stuck and crystallize their beliefs.
Right. I mean, that's and I think I'm in a unique position in that way, because I'm not coming from a scholarly point of view where I'm having to stake my reputation. I mean, so often what you see with, especially in scholarly research, is that they'll wait till the end of their career after they retire to say what they really think. Because otherwise they're laying their pension, they're laying their livelihood on the line. Well, I'm always laying my livelihood on the line, but it's in a sense of, hey, you know, there's important knowledge that we all need to gather here. We're in a game, and the clock is ticking, and there is a light side and there is a dark side. And we're trying to learn how to get to the other side here, how to score a goal, to use the game analogy. And, you know, there's a couple of stars in the game, but overall we're all playing here as a team, and we've got to figure out, hey, how are we gonna win here? That's what it's all about.
Well, I'm sure that your visit to Egypt and the discoveries that you made there have certainly helped you answer some of those questions for yourself. And I found the theory that you're postulating about the sun, moon, earth, temple system of souls quite fascinating. Would you expand on that for the listeners?
Yeah, because I was in Egypt for the total solar eclipse of the sun, it prompted me to say, hey, why don't we take a look at this moon relationship, especially to ancient Egypt. I mean, especially when we're talking about the Great Pyramids, ancient Egyptian myth and legend credits the god Tahuti or Thoth as being the designer of the pyramid. He's also the moon god. So the natural question would be, is there a connection? And what you find is that there's numerous connections between especially Egypt and the moon, the pyramids and the moon, the sacred geometry of the pyramid matching that of the moon. And it just seems to be kind of an overlooked sort of perception here when we're studying, especially these ancient civilizations, is we're always on the earth looking out into the stars. But as Sitchin prompted us to do in the 12th planet, maybe we should start looking at our earth and these temples that were constructed from the outside in, as if, you know, the beings were coming from the stars and helping to create these temples and dwelling in these temples, because they're star beings who are ultimately trying to teach us to become star beings too.
Let's talk about that connection between the sun, the moon, and the earth through the eclipse. the majesty of an eclipse can only occur because of this incredible sacred geometry that exists between the Earth, the Moon and the Sun, and the proportions of all of them. The Sun is completely blacked out by the Moon. And even though they are completely different sizes, they appear to be the same size to our eyes from here on Earth. Let's go into the sacred geometry that exists there. And you mentioned before about the geometry of the pyramid matching that of the Moon. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, I have a slide in that presentation that I'm bringing up right now here as we're speaking in my PowerPoint presentation to read it to you exactly, because it's as much a statement of sacred geometry as it is a visualization. I mean, it is in my view a sort of attunement in and of itself. So it's going to take just a moment for that to come up, and I'll be happy to read that to you because I want to get it exact. So if there's another part of that question we can look at and we can come back to that, that would be most helpful.
Well, obviously, I'd love to know, when you decided to talk about the Sun, Moon, Earth temple system, it was because you were heading over to Egypt for the eclipse. You'd never seen an eclipse before, had you?
No.
Tell me about the moment that you hit totality.
Well, it was very strange, in fact, how it all played out, almost like it was orchestrated from another realm. I mean, really, we had planned to go to be in the path of totality, which meant we had to go to the edge of Egypt, close to Libya, and we had planned to be part of a group of, say, 3,000 to 5,000 people that were going to be there at that moment. Well, it turned out more like 40,000 to 50,000 people descended on Egypt for this experience. And as it turned out, the authorities said, hey, we don't have accommodations for that kind of people. We don't have the ability to handle that kind of volume of people coming into this area. So we decided that we would go to a virtually abandoned archaeological site called Abu Ghraib, which was known as the Stargate, or as a Stargate, literally, in the ancient world to experience the eclipse. And so that's where we ended up being, and it was just absolutely remarkable to be at the place where ancient Egyptian myth and legend says the star beings originally came to Earth through what they described as a portal or a gateway, and to be there at a time when we have this amazing magical moment unfolding, this eclipse.
And I believe that it was a completely cloudless sky, is that right?
It was, and I've got a picture of, as I look at the presentations that I'm doing about Abu Ghraib later, we have this pristine blue sky in some of the slides, and then I'm looking at it going, wait a minute, how come the sky's all of a sudden so dark? Then I remembered, oh yeah, that's right, there was the eclipse going on there. So, I mean, it's not like night and day when the eclipse begins, but it's pretty close.
What were your feelings when you actually saw the moment of totality? I believe it lasted for 4.5 minutes, didn't it?
That's right.
Wow.
Eerie. I mean, it's incredibly eerie. I mean, especially we were at Abu Ghraib. You're just 12 miles from Cairo. And when you're standing on top of the mound or pyramid in Abu Ghraib, you can actually see the Giza pyramids. But when you're actually at Abu Ghraib, you literally do feel like you're on the moon. The sand of the Sahara is all that you see. It's very lunar. There's shards of limestone all over the place, scattered all over the place. Hundreds of thousands of these pieces that must have been part of the former limestone temple that stood there. And so you actually, in a sense, felt like you were not just in the middle of nowhere, but on the middle of the moon or something.
Did you have any wild realizations during that moment? Was there anything that really just jumped into your consciousness?
Well, no, other than while at Abu Ghraib, we're at a place that, as it turns out, matches what Sitchin describes as a Anunnaki gold production facility.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during that eclipse, during that time, that I just really felt directly connected to the Anunnaki. I mean, I have been researching these beings that allegedly, or I believe, did come to Earth thousands and thousands of years ago, and have seen their cylinder seals in museums, have connected with them in my imagination and stories, but at this place and during that eclipse, it felt a very definite connection to those beings, and it just had a sense that this is just solidness. Was the real feeling of a solid connection between that place and what the Anunnaki were doing here on Earth.
And how did that connection feel to you? Did it feel like a good connection, or I mean, what is your attitude, or you know, how do you feel about the Anunnaki?
Well, I feel that the word that pops into my mind is they're pretty practical beings. They, when we look at the technology that they left, for example, this Abu Ghraib site, it is clearly a, in my opinion, what they were doing was channeling water in from the Nile, and they were probably using the water as a power source. But I also believe that they were mining gold out of the water as well. And so when you look at this site like Abu Ghraib, not only was it a power source, not only were they mining gold out of the water, but it's a place that must have been just amazingly beautiful when it was originally constructed. I mean, we would look at it as an actual work of art. And so when I think of the Anunnaki and try to connect with their stories and connect with them to a place like Abu Ghraib, I'm recalling the reason that they're here is not for a holiday. They're not here on a voyage of exploration. These aren't people from Star Trek. These are beings that were here on a rescue mission. There had been a terrible celestial cataclysm, a cosmic catastrophe. Souls were drowning in the cosmic ocean, and Earth was their life raft. And they came here in order to not mine gold from the waters of Earth. They came here to mine, in my opinion, souls. And so all of their mission, their purpose for being here is for the purpose of returning the souls that are here on Earth to their source.
Well, I'd like to know what the connection is between the Anunnaki then and the beings that inhabited Atlantis. Can you tell me if they're the same group of beings?
Well, it's hard to say, Liz, because in Plato's story of Atlantis, and I'll repeat Plato's story, I mean, it may be history, but it may also just simply be his fictional account, which originally came from Egypt, he tells of these divine beings who came to Earth and created a hybrid race of semi-divine beings, humans. And these humans had a divine essence, a divine spark. The alchemists talk about this. The early Christians, the Gnostics talk about this at the time of early Christianity. And what happened in Plato's story is that this divine essence began to dissipate. And as Zeus is sitting at the center of the universe, as Plato describes, which may be the center of the universe or it may just be the center of our Milky Way galaxy, Zeus gets a little bit ticked off at this and sends his wrath. And that's where Plato's story cuts off. We don't know exactly how that wrath was sent. We know the ultimate outcome, according to Plato's story, Atlantis is destroyed. A civilization is lost. And so if we backstep and say, well, who were these original divine beings? Were they humanoid types? Did they make us in their image as the book of Genesis describes? Or were they some other type of beings? And then you match up Plato's story of Atlantis with the story of creation told in the Edfu text at the Temple of Horus in Egypt, which says that a group of formless beings came to Earth and created the first civilization in the region of Memphis, in the region of Saqqara, right there near the Great Pyramid. And they built a mound, and they created humankind. And they had technology. They referred to them as relics. And these relics are used by these formless beings, these divine beings. And after a cataclysm in which the original homeland of these formless beings, referred to as the Island of the Egg, is destroyed by cataclysm, they reclaim these relics. I mean, as I follow that path of the story, divine beings come to Earth, create the Island of the Egg, a divine homeland, create a race of beings, their offspring that are destroyed by cataclysm, but they rebuild civilization using their power tools. That sounds like Plato's story of Atlantis to me.
Mm. It definitely does, but there are just so many different stories, and of course when you think of Atlantis, you generally think of an island that's surrounded by water that is probably in the vicinity of the Atlantic Ocean, not so much Egypt and that area around the Great Pyramid. So how do you reconcile those two ideas?
Well, you know, there again, you're forced to ask the question, is Plato's story literal history, or is it just a story? I mean, if it's just a story, then it can be about another place or taking place in another time, for example. So I'm not as hung up on finding the actual location of Atlantis as more trying to get to the heart or the truth of what Atlantis actually was. And in my presentation on Atlantis that I gave in Egypt, which is part of that set you referred to, I go into an exploration of the symbols of Atlantis, which I think are just as important as the story that Plato tells. And when you look at the symbols of Atlantis, which is a cross surrounded by concentric rings, you begin to get some new ideas about what Atlantis actually was, that the concentric rings are always in ancient art and in modern art and symbolism, the symbol for a vibration, like the way you show a cartoon of words leaving the human mouth. They look like concentric rings. But the concentric rings also symbolize a portal or a gateway. And anybody who's watched the Stargate Atlantis show gets this idea that Atlantis may in fact have been more of a portal or a gateway concept than a literal physical place.
Yeah, I actually lean towards that idea, and I love the way that you've tied in that symbolism, which is, you know, two-dimensional, and when you look at a cross and lines around it, you don't initially think of a stargate or a vortex or an opening. However, when you change your perspective and think, okay, this is not a two-dimensional depiction, this is actually showing me something that's three-dimensional, all of a sudden, everything opens up and you have a new view of something that up until that point you'd thought of as something completely different. And that's what you bring to your work. That's what's so wonderful about your work, and it's what's so thought-provoking about your work.
It causes brain cells to grow. It causes synapses and neurons to join. That's why it's sort of an attunement. At least that's how it was for me. And, you know, just the backstory on that, as I showed in that presentation, that's going from looking at the two-dimensional image of the concentric rings as representative of a 3D experience, that came from NASA and their depiction of the way they portrayed a warp craft, their term, a warp craft entering a stargate or a wormhole. They portrayed that wormhole as concentric rings, and they showed the warp craft going into the concentric rings and coming out in a galaxy clear across the other side. So all I did is went back and applied that to the story of Atlantis and these divine beings that came from the stars. How did they get here?
Wormholes.
Wormholes. Hello? And we're coming back around to where we have the brain power or the consciousness to be able to recognize this and actually do something with this knowledge.
The whole thing about wormhole theory that is wonderful is that it's bridging this ancient sacred spiritual science, and it's bringing together what's at the leading edge of modern science today, and you call this the synthesis of these two things Stargate metaphysics, and so that's what Atlantis is to you, isn't it? It's really the metaphysics of stargates and how advanced civilizations and beings from those civilizations have entered our realm here on Earth.
That's right, and when we really get a hold of and flesh out this wormhole metaphysics, and the basis for that or the idea behind that is, like, for example, pick a movie, Contact, Stargate, the TV series Stargate, any of these shows that deal with the concepts of portals, parallel dimensions, all this sort of thing, they almost always, I can't think of a contrary example, they always show the humans entering the gate just simply walking through them, like you and I would walk out the door right now and enter another room. But the clear distinction that the ancients made is that before you enter that gateway, that portal, there was a profound mental, physical, spiritual, emotional transformation that was undergone preparatory to that experience. And that's what the gods taught. And that's what's largely missing in most of our religious teachings and other places where we find references to the gates of the gods. And that's what I feel we have to recover is the technology, the spiritual metaphysics that complements or is actually a requirement for traveling through these portal or gateways. And this is what the reason why this is so is, for example, the movie Contact was, the story of Contact was written by Carl Sagan, probably one of the least spiritual people that have ever lived on this planet, that refutes the whole idea of spirit and connection to the stars with star beings and this sort of thing. So no wonder we get these views of stargates this way. Star Trek, Stargate, these are all military people typically that are interacting with these gates. So it's always talking about the militarization of space rather than the spiritualization of space. And that's what the ancient stories most often refer to.
We're speaking with William Henry, and we'll be back in just a few minutes to continue our dialogue about Egypt, the ancient technology of the pyramids, and all about the discovery that he made with a team from National Geographic. So we'll be back very soon. This is Otherwhere. You're listening to BBS Radio, and I'm Liz Miller.
Otherwhere.
Welcome back to the show. And that one went out especially to each one of you, especially all of you who can fly. It's from Blaze and the Underground Artists for Life, featuring former Otherwear guest Joy Cardwell on vocals. And that was the Blaze Shrine vocal remix of Be Yourself.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We're here with William Henry, investigative mythologist extraordinaire and master of connecting the dots between ancient myth, scripture and symbolism. Welcome back, William. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Liz. I appreciate you having me back.
Thank you. Now, I want to get into this discovery that you made at Abu Ghraib. You touched on it earlier, but I think this is so exciting because for the first time, I believe, someone has come up with a connection, actual evidence, between the pyramids in Egypt and the pyramids at Teotihuacan in Mexico.
Right. This is an amazing story that just sort of unfolded. It was very much like being a part of just a discovery, really. I mean, which is sounds kind of silly to say, but it's just a really neat thing to be a part of. If anybody's ever been work with a group of people where all of a sudden you're making connections and things are coming together and you get that aha, you know, how exciting that is. I had gone to Abu Ghraib, which is, again, just about a 20-minute drive from the Great Pyramid. Officially, it's a closed archaeological site. It's way off the tourist beaten path. And no wonder. The place is pretty fragile. It's pristine archaeologically, but it's very fragile. In terms of it not being quite, it's not like the Great Pyramid where on a daily basis thousands and thousands and thousands of people mill around like ants on top of an apple or something. Abu Ghraib is far more fragile and can barely handle the 30 people that we had there. It's just not set up for as a tourist attraction. And so we're walking around this place and we're seeing the courtyard in front of it. You see the mound as it has sat for probably the past 5,000 years in a state of pretty severe deterioration. And in front of this mound, you have this gigantic alabaster platform. Now, alabaster is Egyptian crystal. And you're looking at this platform that's about 4 feet high and about 15 feet wide on each side. And perfectly smooth on the top, it looks like a mandala. In fact, it's shaped like the Egyptian sign or symbol called Hotep, which means peace. And so archaeologists have believed that this was some kind of massive ancient offering table. But the indigenous oral Egyptian tradition teaches that this was the place where the gods originally came down. This was a portal or a gateway, what I would refer to as a star gateway or stargate, where the gods originally descended. And perhaps this Egyptian crystal platform marks the location where this occurred, or perhaps it was actually a useful tool, sort of like some kind of a transporter room or something, where the gods literally manifested or appeared on Earth. We're not sure which, but either way, this enormous alabaster platform is probably the most bizarre artifact I've ever seen. In fact, a gentleman who is along with us, a cameraman, Ted St. Rain, who's traveled to Baalbek, Lebanon with Sitchin, he's been throughout Syria with Sitchin, he's been in South America with Sitchin. This is simply the most, the top three bizarre place he has ever seen. And it's thought to be Egypt's oldest ceremonial center. And so when you put all that together, you're dealing with an incredibly strange and incredibly wonderful place.
Tell me about the coating that you found on the mound there, that alabaster. Is it a form of mica?
Well, actually, we found mica laying on the surface of the courtyard, as if the courtyard itself was a massive slab or floor of mica, which was very interesting because as Ted was walking around, he's seeing, and we're seeing that one of the great enigmas, the other great enigmas at Abu Ghraib, are these giant alabaster basins. They're bowls that have gear work around the outside of them and perfectly circular holes bored into them. And people, archaeologists have looked at this and said, oh, these must have been offering basins. You can imagine them slaughtering animals and the blood running around these bowls and coming out through these perfectly circular holes. Christopher Dunn, author of Giza Power Plant, has looked at these holes and said, these are drilled. Somebody had power tools when they made these things. Look how, feel how perfectly smooth these bowls are. Look at these perfectly circular holes that are drilled through these alabaster basins. These are made with power tools of some kind. And it's been a giant enigma exactly what those bowls were used for. Well, Ted's walking around there, and we see, I don't know, 15 or so of these bowls kind of scattered around. And he says, you know what? Sitchin's book, The Lost Realms, is the real key to tell us exactly what we're looking at here. Sitchin describes the pyramid of the sun and moon complex at Teotihuacan, and he tells how water was brought in through canals into this place, and that the Anunnaki built the pyramids at Teotihuacan as gold refining facilities. And they were using giant slabs of mica sandwiched into various places at Teotihuacan for its piezoelectric effect, and were literally zapping the water through the mica and causing gold to fall out of the water. Well, as we're walking around Abu Ghraib, we're seeing exactly the same arrangement. We're seeing the mica. We're seeing the pyramid. We're seeing the sluices. That's what we believe those basins actually were water sluices. Archaeologists, Egyptologists tell us that water was channeled into Abu Ghraib from the nearby Nile. For what purpose? What were they doing with it? Well, the answer seems to be they were doing the exact same thing at Abu Ghraib that they were doing at Teotihuacan. And one of the links that I made when I came home that was most provocative to me is that Teotihuacan is called the place of the gods. It's also called the place of cattail reeds, or simply the place of reeds. The ancient Egyptian texts that seem to refer to Abu Ghraib describe the original domain of the gods as at Abu Ghraib in that vicinity as the place of reeds. Both of these locations share the same name, as if they're part of some corporate conglomerate or something. It's like if you saw a Ford Motor plant in Australia and you saw the same thing in Detroit and both of them had the Ford logo on them, you'd get the pretty clear idea, hey, they manufacture the same thing here, or it's the same company manufacturing a product here. You get the same sense at Teotihuacan when you study it and you study Abu Ghraib. They appear to be, both have been part of the same conglomerate of gold miners that Sitchin believes were called the Anunnaki, who came to this planet to mine gold, but while they're here, we're actually here for other purposes.
Well, we know that there is a worldwide system of pyramids that have been set up, and mm-hmm. that they have been placed on very specific grid points on the planet. And the main one, of course, is the Great Pyramid, which sits right in the center of the landmass of Earth, kind of indicating that it's there as a stabilizing point. It would then make so much sense that the same intelligence designed all of these pyramids and placed them in all of these remote areas, maybe not at the same time, perhaps over different, you know, epochs. However, they are now there as testaments to, you know, someone's understanding that these pyramids could perform many different functions. One of them would be to stabilize the Earth and to help perhaps make Earth friendlier for life here.
And that takes us back to our earlier discussion about the pyramid and the moon and the sun.
Yeah.
Because if you take away the moon, there's no tectonic activity on this planet. You take out the tectonic plates, there's no tides. You take away the tides because there's no moon, then there's no life in the ocean.
Okay, and then let's take it on, you know, above that, from the 3D level, say to the 4D and above level. We're looking at an Earth that is not just physical. The Earth has its own aura or light body mm-hmm. or etheric system. And I know that you've talked about the portals that exist, if the Earth has a shape that is the same as a dodecahedron, or a 12-pointed pyramid,
right.
Each of those points could represent portals to access 3D Earth from any other realm. And so the pyramids, do you think they have, another level where they're working on that electromagnetic grid system of the Earth and the Earth's light body?
I absolutely think so, and it seems to be a musical system. It's understood from the perspective not of the Earth, but looking at the Earth from afar, perhaps even from the Moon. And by the way, we talked about that the sacred geometry, the connection between the pyramid and the Moon earlier, and I mentioned it's sort of a visualization. Well, I found that, so let me, if you like, I can read that to you.
Please do.
Okay, and we can utilize this as sort of a visualization. If people are at home, they can do this. What I want you to do is maybe close your eyes. And imagine a big triangle that is the same proportion and angle of the Great Pyramid with its base angles at 51 degrees, 51 minutes. Now, bisect this triangle and assign a value of 1 to each base. This is going to equal the phi number, 1.618. Now, holding that image of the bisected pyramid, you have a big pyramid, a big triangle, with its angles at 51 degrees, you bisect this triangle. Now, draw a circle with its center and diameter the same as the base of the large triangle. This will represent the circumference of the Earth. Now, draw a square that touches the outside of the Earth's circle. And then a second circle is drawn around the first one with its circumference equal to the perimeter of the square. This is called the squaring of the circle. This new circle will actually pass exactly through the apex of the pyramid. And now here's the wow. A circle drawn with its center at the apex of the pyramid and its radius just long enough to touch the Earth's circle will have the circumference of the Moon.
Wow.
I mean, what that says is several things to me, that this is a system that has been designed. I mean, and one of the big conundrums of science is who built the Moon? How did the Moon get here?
Yeah, and it really, for me, it puts sacred into sacred geometry. It makes me understand why it's sacred.
Right. I mean, this whole thing is I call it a temple of souls. It was set up so that life could emerge, so that then the bipedal human form could emerge on land, and this bipedal human form with its spinal cord system and the brain-mind system that attached is the stairway to heaven from our soul's perspective. And if any of these conditions are not met on Earth, and these conditions, again, are created by the Earth-Moon relationship, then we don't have a stairway to heaven for our soul that I can see. We have to begin to look at this whole thing as being designed by a designer from the outside who set this up as a temple for the souls who suffered, apparently, or according to Sumerian, that the terrible celestial cataclysm. This place is set up for those souls to return home.
And how do you think the Great Pyramid interacts with our souls?
Well, that's a very good question, because what you have to decide is, in the model of Chris Dunn and other researchers like Stephen Mailer, Joseph Farrell, others that view the pyramid as a power plant or as a weapon system, you have to look at that and say, you know, what spiritual function does this thing really possess? When I was in there in the Great Pyramid just a couple of months ago, I mean, you get the sense, you shrink yourself down to the size of a pea and roll yourself around the inside of a modern Corvette engine. You know, that's kind of the feeling that you get inside that thing. But then you also, whether by design or by just your own imagination, you also you're compelled to apply a spiritual connection to it as well. And I've had what I consider to be spiritual experiences inside the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid. But you have to ask yourself, you know, can an ant also have a spiritual experience inside of a Corvette engine? You know? Does that make sense?
Of course it makes sense. It's a funny analogy.
I mean, you just, because you're clearly in the hands and dealing with something way beyond, or what has previously been way beyond our understanding.
Mm.
But today, we, with our technical ability, we seem to be coming into an era where we can more readily apprehend, hey, we get what this thing is.
How old do you think the Great Pyramid is?
Personally, I go along with the idea of the indigenous Egyptians that think it's at least 50,000 years old.
And do you believe that it's actually the one that we can see right now is built on top of the foundations of a much older one, or do you think this is the one that's always been there?
I don't know. That's a good question. There's so much talk about the tunnel systems that run underneath Giza. You have Herodotus talking about the labyrinth that runs underneath Cairo. I wouldn't be surprised if there is one beneath it, but I don't have any personal evidence or ideas to suggest that that's actually so. In regards to the Great Pyramid, though, Zahi Hawass was just here in Nashville last week. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and he came here to introduce the Quest for Immortality exhibit. It's the largest collection of traveling Egyptian artifacts outside of Egypt, all of it geared towards Thutmose III, who is the founder of the Rosicrucians, and his quest for immortality. And while Zahi was here, he announced that later this year he will reveal the secrets of the pyramid. He will be revealing the tomb of Khufu inside the Great Pyramid later this year. That's huge.
That is huge.
I mean, just like, wow, and half the audience kind of gets it, but when you start adding it together, so it was kind of funny. We had a Q&A after his presentation, and I got to ask him the second question, which was, Zahi, a friend of mine was at a presentation you gave in Cairo back in 1999, in which you showed a diagram of the golden capstone you intended to put on top of the pyramid for the millennium. And this drawing showed an Egyptian heron, the bird of light, on top of a pillar, which is highly significant. And my question to him was, well, you didn't do that. Why not? And what happened to that golden capstone? And he got all puffed up. He was really excited by the question. And he said, hey, that was my project. I wanted to do that. I wanted to put the golden capstone on the pyramid because that would attract millions of people to Egypt. Everyone would want to see this, which they would. But he said the press and people said it was too Masonic, so he decided not to do it. But you can tell, at least I got the sense, that he's got a very nasty reputation as being really anti-anything alternative, and that's being polite. But and so therefore he's withholding the true secrets of the pyramid, and he's selling off artifacts. I mean, the litany of accusations is long, and it gets nastier and dirtier the deeper down you go. I kind of get the sense from listening to him, especially these comments he's making about revealing the secrets of the pyramid later this year, that he would like to reveal these secrets, but he can't. And because I think he wants to go down in history as the world's greatest Egyptologist, and in order to do that, he wants to complete the pyramid. And when you complete that pyramid, you are fulfilling all kinds of prophecies about the missing capstone, the stone the builders rejected, so on and so forth. But again, he said, later this year, secrets of the Great Pyramid, I will be revealing them, and the tomb of Khufu will be revealed. And my sense is, man, okay, you know, the contrary statements you get are, well, he's already been in there. He's already taken everything out. Well, maybe, but whatever's left, I will bet anything, can only be interpreted with esoteric eyes. And it's going to be dramatically and overtly esoteric, whatever he shows us.
You know, there was a report that I haven't seen anything written about since that came out in 2004 that was published on the BBC News website about how archaeologists were at the site of the Library of Alexandria and had rediscovered it and found chambers beneath the surface. There were 13 of those chambers, apparently. And as far as I can tell, I haven't been able to find any other references to this discovery, which the Library of Alexandria is one of the most important archaeological finds I could imagine ever being sort of discovered.
Right.
Do you know anything about this?
I haven't heard a thing about that, Liz, no, but Zahi Hawass did mention in the same presentation I mentioned a moment ago here in Nashville last week that they found what they believed to be an Osiris temple in Alexandria.
Really?
Which could be one of those temples or chambers that you're talking about.
Interesting. And what about the chambers beneath the Sphinx? When you were over in Egypt, did you get to talk to anybody about those chambers that are purportedly there?
No, I really didn't. I mean, it's the thing that blew my mind as concerns the Sphinx is there's this really interesting connection between Thutmose the IV. He's the son of Thutmose the III, and he has this dream in which he's laying his head on the stone beneath the Sphinx's chin or near its paw or somewhere around the Sphinx, and the Sphinx tells him, "Hey, if you'll clear away the sand from my body, I'll make you a pharaoh." And so he does, and we have the Sphinx completely unburied today, as it must have been in his time. It was later reburied and then unburied by Napoleon and his army. But that story of Thutmose the IV laying his head on a stone and falling into a dream is strikingly similar to the story of Jacob's ladder. When Jacob laid his head on a stone and saw a ladder ascending into the heavens with angels ascending and descending on either side, the name of the place where Jacob had his experience was called Luz. The original name of the Great Pyramids was called Akh, A-K-H, or Aku, which means shining or light. And so it makes you wonder, is Jacob's pillar or Jacob's ladder the Great Pyramid? Well, when I'm at the Sphinx this time, I didn't even notice this the last time. That's what makes it so wild when you see stuff like this. Is in between the paws of the Sphinx, there is a red granite altar stone. And when you put a pendulum on that red granite altar stone, it starts spinning in a vortex, like, wildly. And so it leads you back to this idea that maybe Jacob's ladder's experience took place, if it was at a physical location, at the Sphinx, and that altar stone is in fact marking a place of a vortex or a connection, and that is the real hall or hole of records that everybody's actually looking for.
You're listening to an interview with William Henry. If you'd like to find out more about William's work, you can do so by checking him out on the net at williamhenry.net. You're tuned in to Otherwhere. My name's Liz Miller, and we'll be back to conclude the final portion of our interview with William, and shortly after that, we'll be going into our progressive yoga relaxation. So, during the break, find somewhere comfortable where you won't be disturbed, unplug the phone, get yourself a blanket to keep warm, and a pillow if you'd like to pop it under your knees, anything that you need to do to prepare for the progressive yoga relaxation, which is coming up right at the end of the show. Here's our last track for the night. Let's have a listen to Straight Magic. It's from the Ananda Project and a release from our proud sponsors here at Otherwear, King Street and Night Grooves Records. You can find them online at kingstreetsounds.com.
BlogTalkRadio.com.
Welcome back to Otherware with our guest, William Henry.
What do you think has been your biggest discovery, William, so far in your career?
Boy, it's hard to say because I'm just beginning, really. One of the thing that pops to my mind is trying to answer the question of, let's just talk about Jesus for a second. In early Christian art, he's portrayed over and over again, short-haired, clean-shaven, and he has a magic wand in his hand. What is that magic wand? What was he doing with that? Is that a literal piece of spiritual technology? Is that wand a baton? Is he like a symphony conductor conducting the key of life, the symphony of life? When you come upon depictions like that and start following it, you're led back to Egypt, and you're now all of a sudden you're making some of these discoveries that, wait a minute, there was a whole spiritual technology that is being withheld from us. And as soon as you begin to follow those pieces, one discovery after another just follows in rapid succession.
And have you answered to your satisfaction what the meaning of the pyramids and how they relate to our existence here on Earth? Have you answered that for yourself?
No. No, absolutely not. And it is, it's, that's why it's called initiation. I mean, you're still following the path, and ultimately the path is leading to the other side. And that's, so you really won't answer the question until you know you get to the other side. I mean, it's sort of like the marathon runner who decides he's going to run a marathon. At what point does the marathon runner know whether or not he's trained enough for the marathon? And to me, the answer is when he finishes the race. And so for me and other people that are on a similar path, we really won't know if we did enough research, if we got enough answers, until we actually finish the race, which means we get to the other side, however we want to define that personally.
There's something that I'm dying to ask you about, and it might be a bit tangential, but it
don't die.
it has to do with the language of the birds.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the books that you've written, and one of the subjects that you've written about, I should say, and the title of one of your books.
Right.
And you say that this is the original mystery school language, mm-hmm. and that it was possibly also spoken in the Garden of Eden.
Right.
Could you tell me about the relationship this language has to the bird tribes, to Horus, to the relationship that Egypt and Egypt symbolism has to this depiction of a falcon or a hawk figure?
Right. I mean, it's absolutely amazing. It's so subtle, and one of those, another just incredibly powerful connections. The language of the birds, according not just to me, but to the alchemist Falconelli, for example, this was the language of the gods. It was the language spoken by these enlightened beings. For example, I mean, John Anthony West notes that when you see the pharaoh with the falcon or hawk of Horus behind him, it signifies not only protection, it also signifies enlightenment, awakening. And this was the primary teaching of this tribe of beings that were portrayed with either the head of the bird or bird's feathers, for example, in the case of Ptah, the Egyptian god of smithcraft and alchemy. And I just found some amazing correlations. I mean, and it was actually Falconelli, the alchemist, that said that English is the language of the birds. It's the language of the gods. And by utilizing phonetic resonance, the similarity between words or the sound of words, you connect the dots between seemingly unconnected ideas or concepts or things. The example that I cite that illustrates this is the language of the birds. What are we talking about? What is a bird? And how is it connected to other ideas? And for example, when a child who has had difficulty saying the letter R looks at a bird, sometimes at a certain age, young age, they'll call it a bud. They'll say, look at the bud in the tree, and the parent understands they're talking about a bird. But then when you examine the word bud, B-U-D, you find that that refers to a blossom, like a flower blossom, a flower buds, or a tree buds. And so now we're talking the language of flowers, the language of trees, which Falconelli said is what the language of the birds is. It's the language of nature and the language that connects all things in nature. But reexamining the word bud, you find that a bud is not just a blossom. A bud is an awakened being, as in the case of the Buddha or Buddha. And so here you get this connection then that the language of the birds, exemplified by the hawk-headed Horus, the enlightened one, is the language of nature that brings about awakening. And it's, in fact, the language of the awakened ones, and it has to do with the phonetic similarities of words, and that's what English allows. It's like a code language that enables you to go into any language and trace phonetic similarities.
Wow. The most wonderful thing I think about listening to you speak, especially about words, is this ability that you have to be so playful with them and to find connections between words, not only within the English language, but in other languages, and sort of find this narrative or commonality that exists between them all, and then you're able to actually to construct whole realities around these words.
Well, I mean, yeah, I know. Scholars accuse me of babbling. But what they don't recognize is that the word babble originally meant gate, stairway to heaven, as in the Tower of Babel. And that was the incident when God, Yahweh, Jehovah, came down and destroyed our tower or gate, our stairway to heaven, and separated humankind, how? By language. Before the Tower of Babel incident, humankind was united by one language.
And that was the language of the birds.
Falconelli says it was English. I'm just following it up and saying, well, isn't it interesting that if you use English as a decoder language, which, by the way, English was introduced as a literary language with the publication of the King James Version of the Bible by Sir Francis Bacon, the modern founder of the Rosicrucians, and some say the Illuminati. If English isn't introduced by Bacon as a literary language, we're speaking French or Latin or something else, and we don't have this decoder language. But that was one of the key things that Bacon did as the master of the secret society, was introduce this newly made-up language, English, as the literary language that unified the world. That is the language of science, it's the language of commerce, it's the language of the Internet.
Do you think that Bacon was Shakespeare?
I'm not sure. I think, though, that Bacon's technique of concealing ideas in code and in literary and visual code was used in the Shakespearean dramas. So I think he probably was part of this mystery school, this secret society that was using Shakespeare's dramas as a way to transmit this knowledge along with the King James Version of the Bible.
So then Shakespeare would have been speaking the language of the bards.
That's the language of the bards. There you go. And what is a bard? A bard is a bird, but a bard is also a poet, a wise one, a druid.
It's just very amazing.
Good, Liz. It is. I mean, it's like, I'll take it. It works for me.
It strangely works for me, too.
Well, we're part of the same tribe.
I agree. I definitely agree. And just on that subject of the language of the birds, you were recently talking about the language of the birds in a promo on Dreamland, which is a radio program that Whitley Strieber hosts. But every now and then you take over the reins and host the show for him. And recently there was an interview with Starfire Tor, who is somebody who deals with dual timelines and exploring time shifts. And the reason why I'm asking you about this is because I've become, since hearing that interview, a member of Starfire's ID list on Yahoo Groups. And
oh, cool.
There's been a lot of chatter about the language of the birds.
Uh-huh.
Because...
A lot of chirping, huh?
No, apparently Whitley remembered when he produced the promos about the language of the birds and about Starfire's show, he mentioned that Starfire happened to mention the language of the birds during her interview.
Right.
However, it never came up during the interview. And
oh, you're kidding.
No, and neither Starfire nor Brandon can actually remember discussing it with Whitley.
You're kidding me.
However, there could be a dual timeline that's coexisting here where Whitley and Anne remember a conversation about this, the language of the birds. And I just had to bring it up.
That's wild, yeah. I mean, I hadn't listened to that interview with her. Whitley called saying they had talked and she mentioned it. And I guess, I mean, I'm just talking off the top of my head here, as I recall that she had mentioned something about she time travel from the future when they were using the language of the birds or something like that. And so we thought that it would be a tie-in. So that's interesting. So she never mentioned it, huh?
Yeah, so we really want to try and get to the bottom of this great mystery.
That is a mystery for sure.
And it's a well-documented mystery. There are so many people who have the actual recordings. The only person I think that hasn't really been asked is Whitley himself, which would probably help a lot. So if you get a chance, I'd love it if you could ask him about that and get back to us. And I have a request from Starfire. She says she'd love to get a copy of Language of the Birds.
Oh, great. Yeah, sure. So if you can order it from Whitley.
Well, thank you so much for indulging me on that one. I just had to ask.
No, I'm glad she did. I mean, I had no idea. That's very interesting.
Mm.
Yeah, if she just have Starfire email me, I'll be happy to drop her a copy of the book. I think she'd find it very interesting.
Yeah, we think that there must be a higher purpose to this whole episode, and I don't know if you can find one, but there's some strange synchronicity, and I guess that what everybody has decided is that ultimately what this means is that she just needs to read the book.
There you go.
And find out how it could tie in with her.
Okay.
I'd like your comments on this statement. It's a quote from Philip K. Dick, seeing that we're on the wordsmithing tip at the moment.
Uh-huh.
He said once that the basic tool for the manipulation of reality is the manipulation of words. If you can control the meaning of words, you can control the people who you must use the words.
Right. Yeah.
How does that make you feel when you hear that?
No, I think that's exactly it, because certain words we're not allowed to use. Some of them, most of those words that we're not allowed to use refer to the excretory functions of our body. And my take is that they don't want us talking about our excretory functions of our body, because they don't want us, one, to recognize that everything that comes out of the front of the body is holy, for one thing, and that the body is, in fact, a manufacturing plant that excretes these various things, which are then tightly controlled. I mean, everything that comes out of my mouth, like everything that comes out of the other orifices of my body, is tightly regulated. And it's just not stuff we're allowed to talk about in public discourse, not on the airwaves, not on radio, not on TV. And my thinking is that if you want to control the excretory functions of the body, then you're also wanting to control the secretions that the body is capable of manufacturing as well. And that's what takes you into this whole idea of the pineal gland as a power plant, that once it blossoms as a plant, releases the secretions that contain the secrets that begin to transmute this human power plant, this manufacturing facility, into something incredibly powerful.
Wow. Do you think that the Great Pyramid of Giza could be the physical manifestation of the Earth's pineal gland?
It could well be. I mean, it's shaped like it. It has a similar conical shape. It seems to be, it's in the center of the Earth's land masses, like the pineal gland is in the center of the brain. So there's lots of neat correlations that you could make of the Giza power plant and the pineal plant, both of them releasing some form of a secretion or an emanation that brings about awakening or enables it to radiate tremendous power. But again, that's why I think we just can't talk about these functions of the body.
William, it's nearly time for us to go. Thank you so much for all of your time. It's just been
my pleasure.
Liz,
anytime.
It's just been great. Before we go, I just wanted to ask you a couple of very, very quick questions that you can just reel off a one-word answer to if you like. Do you have a favorite celestial object or constellation?
Ursa Major, the Big Dipper.
If you could time travel to any point in time, where would you go?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think I would like to be there when the first Anunnaki came to Earth.
And if it were only a one-way trip, would you still go?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Is there something that you hope that you can do, like perhaps travel into space, that you'll be able to do before your life ends this time around?
Well, I'd like to go to Iraq. I would like to know. I would like to be able to see those that library in Baghdad put back together. I would like to see be able to go to Ur and to some of those sites in Iraq that we're now flipping into military facilities. I would like to think that we're going to be able to heal that whole situation and be able to open up that part of the ancient mind to people, because that ultimately is where a lot of the secrets are.
And do you have a favorite piece of art?
A bunch of them, yeah. I mean, just one of my favorites here in my office, I have the depiction of Akhenaten and Nefertiti breathing in the rays of the celestial disc, the Aten, and Akhenaten then breathing those rays into his daughter's nostrils, just the way Jesus transmitted the Holy Spirit to the disciples and the way Adam was given life in Genesis. I love art like that.
That is such a beautiful, beautiful image. It's so evocative. And if you could invite anyone from any time, from any myth or legend or living, to dinner, which three guests would you invite?
Well, right now I would invite, gosh, I'm sounding fixated on him, but I would invite Saddam Hussein, Zachariah Sitchin, and Lawrence Gardner.
Oh, yeah, that would be a good one. If you could think of yourself stopping at a juncture in your life, I know that you started out before you got into all of the esoteric stuff on the path of becoming a music lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
If you had never gone into the esoteric stuff and you'd stayed on that path as a music lawyer, who would your biggest client be?
Pamela Anderson.
Really? Why?
Well, I got into a discussion about this once with a woman. I said, you know, who is, in your opinion, the ultimate example of the divine feminine on the planet? And I said Dolly Parton, because I've met people that have managed Dolly and known her for years, and the way other celebrities respond to Dolly Parton, they say, hey, she's clearly not from this planet. She has a non-human energy field. And the woman said, well, it can't be Dolly Parton because she's never had children. And so I said, well, who do you think is the ultimate example of the divine feminine on the planet then? And she said, Pamela Anderson. And when you look at Pamela Anderson and Dolly Parton and compare, they're strikingly similar. And so I say that because I have a sense that I always would have gravitated towards whoever's the ultimate example of the divine feminine on the planet. It could be Dolly Parton, it could be Pamela Anderson. Angelina Jolie is certainly trying to put herself in the running for stepping into that office. Madonna tried but failed. So I don't know. I just think that if I had continued on that path, hopefully I would have struck up somehow a resonance with that kind of energy.
Yeah. And on another parallel timeline, what would another version of you be doing?
I would have two things. You know, when I would have been kicking footballs. I would have been kicking field goals, either playing soccer or playing football, American-style football.
Wow, I never would have picked you for a sporty jock type.
Well, yeah, I was a total jock type growing up. You know, I did the same things today. You know, when I was a kid, I was in the bookstores all day and night reading sports books and playing sports and stuff like that, but I don't know. I think I was just always destined to this. On a personal note, you know, I came home on my 33rd birthday with a piece of moldavite, which is a green stone that you can hold it up to a light and you can see through it. And the lore is that it's part of it. It's a windshield of UFO.
It's actually one of my favorite crystals. It's so beautiful to behold.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really powerful. And so I showed it to my mom, and she said, oh, does that come from Idaho? I'm like, what? I said, no, it comes from Czechoslovakia. And I said, why Idaho? And she said, well, don't you remember when your growing up, we took this trip through Idaho, and we're driving through the craters of the Moon Park, where a meteorite had crashed. And we're driving along, and all of a sudden, from the back of the car, my parents hear this booming voice that says, "Stop the car! Now, Dad!" And it was me. And I made my parents pull over so I could run out and stand in the middle of this field. And my parents are looking at each other going, "What is the matter with this kid?" And so I just guess I was always wanting to sort of connect with whatever's out there, even from a young age. And it's just one of those funny stories I had forgotten about, but kind of clear to me today about what was going on.
Mm. So do you think that you chose to come here?
To come to this planet?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I can't really get that sense. All I know is this is, I'm sure they say this at all times, but this is like an amazing time to be here. And
yes,
I'm convinced that we're surfing the wave right now, and the shore is going to be revealed to us very soon.
Yes, that's interesting in itself. So thank you very much, William.
Sure.
And take good care. We'll speak to you again.
Okay, Liz.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye.
Listening to that interview with William Henry. If you'd like to find out more, once again, please check him out. You can find out about his DVDs and his books, as well as the tours that he offers, at williamhenry.net. And when Otherwhere returns next week, I have a big announcement. We're going to be changing time slots. Yes, we're going to be on Friday evenings from 7 till 9 p.m. That would be following a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. So it's going to be a great night on Fridays. Hope you can join me then with Fred Burks. He's a former language interpreter for Presidents Clinton and Bush, and he now runs the Web of Love. And nowadays, he runs the weboflove.org website, and he is also a part of the team behind wanttoknow.info, a fantastic website. It's a fantastic website. I highly encourage you to go visit it, especially if you're interested in information that's published in the mainstream about secret societies and about groups such as the Bilderbergers, who I think we may be having a chat about next week, considering that they've just had their annual meeting up in Canada, and I know that Fred Burks has been keeping track of all of that. So, now it's time to get really relaxed, lie down somewhere comfortable, or sit in a straight back chair for our progressive yoga relaxation. First of all, make sure that you won't be disturbed for the next 30 minutes or so. Our relaxation is going to be focusing on cleansing and clearing the third eye area, or the sixth chakra, that's located right at the bridge of the nose, just above and in between the eyebrows. The opened third eye is also known as the Eye of Horus and the Horn of the Unicorn. The third eye is an etheric or fourth dimensional eye, and it acts as a sensitive receiver and transmitter by which vibrations of many types can be translated, interpreted, and dispersed into our third dimensional brains for gaining wisdom and illumination. Inner planes, thought forms, and higher entities are perceived through the third eye. A clearer sense of cause and effect are acquired. Now, just like any other eye, it needs a lens to give meaning to the perceived light sensations. And the lens of the third eye is located in the aura, just in front of the sixth chakra. Psychic construction of this lens is part of the discipline that leads to the accurate perception with the inner eye. And we can use this point between the eyes and the center of the forehead as a focal point during meditation, as it helps to facilitate the development of the third eye's lens. And there are nerve centers called the telepathic chakras, also in this area. They're smaller and located around your eyes, at your temples, and behind your ears. And these are the centers for mental communication. These chakras, in lesson learning mode, can be the source of unending mind chatter or the inability to focus mentally or visually. Physical areas affected by these centers are the head, eyes, nose, ears, and mouth. The color of the third eye is indigo, hence we have the term indigo children, whose deep blue auras indicate that they have an open and awakened third eye. This chakra rules our intuition and imagination. It's associated with parts of consciousness concerned with a spiritual view of life. And known as the home of spirit, it has the ability to inform us of the motivation behind actions. We observe the outer life from an inner point of view. Inner vision is ruled by this chakra, and through meditating on it, you gain inspiration and vision of your purpose. The relaxation that we're going to be doing today is going to incorporate a visualization that will help you bring your attention into this area, diagnose it, cleanse it, and then vitalize it. And I do hope that if anything happens during the week where you notice an increase in your multidimensional awareness in whatever way that manifests, please do let me know. And before we begin, a quick word of warning. Just because this is a higher center in our bodies, and it's very important to be aware that we're meditating on a part of our subtle body. And it may happen that when you meditate on your third eye, you might feel that the center of your forehead warms up, or that there is a buzzing sensation, or you see colored lights. These are all very normal effects. It happens because the third eye is attracting the energy of the Kundalini. And although this isn't harmful, it's important to be careful. So if there's a feeling of hotness or possibly itching around the area, just give it a break and come back to it later. And of course, if you're driving or operating machinery, I'd like you to turn off and come back to this later as well. So now, sit upright in a chair or in a comfortable cross-legged posture on a sofa or on a cushion on the floor. Or you can lie down on the floor or a bed. It's better to have a firmer support if possible though. But once you're comfortable and you're settled, close your eyes and ground your energy for a moment. Inhale a deep breath. And gather up all of the tension in your body. And as you breathe it out, send it out through a grounding cord as you can visualize exiting your body from the base of your spine and connecting you to the earth below. Continue to breathe and feel your emotional energy dropping low to the ground as you begin to loosen and give in. Take a few moments and notice the way that you normally breathe. Can you feel yourself breathing? Can you hear the sound of your breath? How deep are your breaths? Feel the movement in your chest and notice how fully you are filling your lungs. It's important to pay attention as we understand and develop the higher mind. New landscapes, new vistas begin to unfold in our reality. And as we work with the energy of the third eye or the sixth chakra, we help facilitate that process even more. So as you listen to the sound of your breath, make this the most important thing you are doing right now. Breathe out any distraction and be present and in your body. Now take in a long, deep breath. Gather up all of the activity of the week. Gather up any tension, hold the breath, then open your mouth and sigh the breath out. And again, breathing in releasing every part of your body with the exhalation. And now imagine your grounding cord. See it constructed of fibers of light connected to the base of your spine and moving down into the earth below you as you establish your connection with the earth. Draw healing earth life force energy up through the grounding cord into your body. And as you exhale, ground your energy, sending out anything that limits you and holds you back from living your fullest potential. And feel yourself now moving into a deep state of gratitude for your connection to Mother Earth, to Gaia. Stay there in that connection for a while. As you do this, feel your heart beginning to open. And now become aware of all of the other people in our circle. We span the globe. Each one of our hearts is a point of light within the otherware circle of light. And you feel yourself stepping forward and joining together with all of us here across all time zones, past, present, and future. We do so knowing that we connect at our deepest essence, at that spark that is divine within all of us. And now, as we all tune into each other, see the lines that intersect the globe, that connect our hearts to each other, forming a network, lines of energy, lines of love, lines of intelligence, lines of power, glowing brightly, forming a web of love that encompasses the deepest essence of all beings here on Earth and throughout creation. Recognize that at your heart center, you have unlimited amounts of love that you can give and receive. Strengthen our circle with that love. Breathe it in and breathe it back out to everybody else. Become aware of your jaw growing easier. Allow your tongue to rest behind your lower teeth. And feel your eyes dropping low into their sockets where they can give in and completely let go. Feel your forehead growing smooth as alabaster, followed by your cheeks, your lips, your chin, and sense that that energy spreads across your scalp so that even your hair follicles release any traces of tension that they may be holding. And if you could see your face right now, you would be able to see how angelic, how beautiful it appears, as you feel yourself connected to the web of love and the Otherwhere circle of lights, allow the image to fade, but allow the feelings to remain. Allow your shoulders and the back of your head to grow heavy. And notice every part of your body following suit, releasing and growing soft. All of the muscles, all of the bones, the organs, and even your nerves are letting go. Feel your entire body beginning to calm down and rebalance. As you breathe in, draw golden light in to nourish every part of your being on every level, physical and non-physical. As the vital energy enters your body with the breath, feel it being sent through all of your nerve centers, through your heart, and into every cell of your body, bringing balance and vitality. Feel your entire body melting into the floor or the support of the chair beneath you. And let the key word be surrender. As you let go of any resistance that you may be encountering from your mind or from thoughts from the outside world that are preventing you from achieving a state of peace. With each out-breath, know that you can give in. You can let go. More and more and more. Now focus your attention at the point between your eyebrows. See the color as an indigo blue. To know exactly that you've centered your eyes on the third eye is very simple. Just draw your eyes towards the center of your forehead by looking upwards at about a 20 to 25 degree angle. And at a particular point, both of your eyes will become still, absolutely motionless. You'll feel as if a force is slowly pulling your eyes towards itself. It will be just like magnetic attraction. And when you experience this state, you know that you'll be at the right point. Now scan and notice any areas of dark, congested, or murky energy, feelings, or colors, or tones. Examine the chakra for any imperfections in any way that you can sense them. Perhaps it is locked up because of past fears, or perhaps you sense it no longer spins in exactly the right way out of neglect. Then visualize your life force energy running through the chakras from the base of your spine all the way up the spine to the sixth chakra in the center of your head, and see it dissolving any unhealthy energy. You can see this energy now coming into the sixth chakra, as well as to the area around your telepathic chakras, as a golden, pearly white light. Release the energy by running it down through your grounding cord and into the earth. Then affirm a healing color like a deep indigo blue or a tone. You can make an R sound or an OM sound, or you can see a healing symbol there. or just feeling in the chakra as you saturate it with life force energy. Visualize setting the openness of this chakra for health. Breathe into the area and relax. Visualize the chakra as a beautiful deep indigo blue, clean and whirling. You may feel now that there is an abundance or a new connection to psychic energy available to you. Feel it charging the air, swirling in and around and filling your third eye chakra with deep vital indigo energy. And note any mental visions as this occurs. See this chakra huge, whirling, and fully charged. Now is a good time to set the intention to create an increase in your multidimensional awareness. Now be still for a few minutes. Inhale and exhale deeply as you continue to concentrate on your third eye, on your brow chakra. As you continue to focus at the brow, feel your entire body is also becoming energized while falling into a deeper and deeper state of inner peace and joy. Notice how heavy your spine and torso have become, your hips, buttocks, thighs, knees, legs, and feet have completely let go. And in the quietness, allow yourself to sink even deeper into this divine state of grace and ease, where you can recharge and revitalize not only the brow chakra, but all of your nerve centers, and your body can have the chance to release deep, deep tensions and cellular memories that have been locked into the cells of your body that you simply don't need to hang on to anymore. Softening, releasing, and letting go. More and more and more. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.